Hi, I'm James.
And I'm Anthony.
And this is Words and Numbers. A ham sandwich walks into a bar, at which point the bartender looks at him and says, "I'm sorry, we don't serve food."
That's not funny, James.
It is literally better than every joke you've ever told in your entire life.
There's a real-life analog to the ham sandwich joke, and that is an unintended consequence. In the 19th century, New York City made it illegal for establishments that served alcohol to not also serve food. The problem is, what do you do if your business is a bar? You don't serve food, you serve beer. That's why your customers come there. And then all of a sudden, the law says you have to serve food. So an unintended consequence arose. Bars would keep on hand food that no one was supposed to eat. There's one in particular that had a ham sandwich. You sat down, you ordered a beer, and the guy would bring you a beer and the ham sandwich. And then the guy in the next table over orders a beer. Bartender comes along, takes away the ham sandwich from you, gives it to the other guy. And so the bar is satisfying the letter of the law that everyone who buys a beer also receives a ham sandwich.
I guess the law said served.
Served, right. It didn't say anyone had to eat it.
And the way this law was written, apparently, given it was the 19th century, we didn't have to care that the ham sandwich was wholly inedible.
That's right. The food laws were somewhat lacking back then. You put me onto a similar story involving buffalo wings.
I might have been wrong about that, too.
Oh, really?
Because I looked it up and found a story about a guy who owned a bar who served up leftover wings, because nobody wanted them, to his son and their friends in the bar he owned. So we've at least got a couple of alternative explanations of the origin of buffalo wings. The other version was that in Buffalo, New York, bars needed to serve food much the same as with the ham sandwich. So they moved on to the absolute cheapest thing they could find, which was wings that later became known as buffalo wings. Those were the same rules I lived under in Utah, where the local majority population were not interested in having bars in their midst in the first place. But if they were going to, you had to buy food too. There was a bar in the same building that my place of employment, Strata, was in. At the end of the day, I would go over there and some people would order a beer and they'd say, "And you want nachos with that?"
Not a question. You do want nachos.
Yeah, that's right. Nachos were the cheapest thing on the menu. And if you were showing up for a beer or two on a Friday, trust me, you were going to have nachos. It was okay that two or three people shared the nachos.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if I could have raised my hand and said something like, "Nachos for everyone." That's the way you would buy a round of beer and then put my plate in the middle of the bar. I don't know what would have happened there.
So a couple of similar stories. Spain imposed a 21% tax on movie tickets.
This all happened in 2012.
Oh, I didn't realize it was that recent. 2012.
Yep, 2012.
So Spain imposes this 21% tax on movie tickets. The unintended consequence is the movie theaters, figuring probably rightly so that their customers aren't going to pay an extra 21%, said, "Fine, we're no longer selling movie tickets. We're selling carrots, which are taxed at 4%. You come to my movie theater, you buy a carrot, which is taxed at 4%, and I'll give you a free ticket to the movies." There's a similar story in Germany, also within the past couple of years. Tampons were taxed at a very high rate.
There's a word I was never expecting to hear on Words and Numbers.
Tampons are taxed at a very high rate. Some entrepreneur comes along and produces a book on tampons. The book had no story to it. I think it maybe had a few pages talking about the history of tampons or something, but that wasn't the cool thing. The cool thing is you open up the book, and there, inside, are a whole bunch of tampons. The book is taxed at a much lower rate than the tampons were. An unintended consequence of the tampon tax.
We really should have thought about that with our book.
Buy Cooperation and Coercion and get a free tampon.
Yeah. That probably sends the wrong message. But if we do this next book that we're doing, which is on, dare I say it, unintended consequences, maybe we should recast our thinking.
So here we have with these unintended consequences, things happening that lawmakers didn't anticipate. Unintended consequences are a bit softer with taxes because you have people specifically trying to get around the tax. The unintended consequences are somewhat more predictable. But these are instances of people wanting to do something, the government standing in their way, and people coming up with creative solutions to how they can do the thing they want to do or the next best thing to it in the face of the law that's prohibiting them from doing what they actually want.
People like to get around laws they can't agree with.
Yeah, which is really strange, given that many people will say the laws reflect the will of the people. Well, if that were the case, you wouldn't have unintended consequences.
We should probably just say this one last time. No matter what you do, there will be unintended consequences.
Yeah, no matter what the law is, no matter how well written, you'll have unintended consequences because it takes away people's abilities to make decisions for themselves.
To get more Ant and James, buy a copy of our excellent book, Cooperation and Coercion. You can find the paper and electronic versions on Amazon and the audio version on Audible. If you'd like to support Words and Numbers, make your way over to patreon.com/wordsandnumbers, where you can contribute to our podcast-making habits. If you'd like to schedule us to come speak at your event, be it corporate or educational, or have James officiate at your wedding, send us an email at wordsandnumberspodcast@gmail.com. This week's episode is a live recording James and I did at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. We apologize for the sound quality. Thanks to our generous supporters at Patreon, we've managed to purchase some better sound equipment, which will save your ears some pain when we do this again in the future.
So here we are at University of North Carolina, Wilmington, recording live an episode of Words and Numbers. We've been doing this for 4 or 5 years now. We're past our 1 millionth download. I'm an economist. James is a political scientist. And we talk about what's going on in the world through the eyes of an economist and a political scientist. And we attempt to keep things nonpartisan. We find admirable and intelligent and meaningful things coming from both the left and the right. And we find abysmally stupid things coming from both the left and the right. And we call all of them as we see them. Today, we're going to be talking about the main theme in our book, Cooperation and Coercion, which you should all run out and buy immediately. Cooperation and Coercion, the subtitle is How Busy Buddies Became Busy Bullies, and what that means for economics and politics. Busy bully is a word that James came up with. We all know what busybodies are, people who stick their nose in our business and they're going to tell us what's good for us, this sort of thing. A busy bully is what happens when a busy buddy encounters government and powers up. And now all of a sudden, not only has an opinion about how you should behave, but can force you to behave the way they think you should behave. I'll give you an example from my home state of Pennsylvania. A couple of years ago, the city council in Philadelphia decided that young people, people like you, people in high school as well, were getting fat. And the city council was going to fix this. And the way they were going to fix it was they determined you were getting fat because you were drinking too much Coke and Pepsi and Mountain Dew and all this nonsense. And so while they couldn't ban these things, they were going to impose a huge tax on them, a 30% tax on the sugary drinks, in an effort to dissuade you from drinking them, thereby making you healthier. So Philadelphia passes this tax. And some time goes by, and they notice that sales of sugary drinks declined precipitously by over a quarter. Sales of sugary drinks declined. The people who were responsible for this law said, look, this is exactly the way government regulation of markets should work. We saw a problem. People were fat. We saw the solution, get them to stop drinking the sugary drinks. We imposed the tax, and lo and behold, that's what happened. To which economists replied, hang on a second. I thought you said the goal was to get these people to stop drinking the sugary drinks. And they said, well, yes, clearly that was the goal, and we've attained it. To which the economist said, no, what happened is the sales of sugary drinks declined. To which the city council says, well, don't be an idiot, economist. Of course, if the sales of sugary drinks decline, people are now consuming less. Well, the economists went out and they actually did some studies. They collected some data on consumption of sugary drinks in the Philadelphia area. And what they found was that consumption of sugary drinks after the tax was no different than it was before. Now, that is a puzzle. How is it possible that the sales of sugary drinks declined precipitously and yet the consumption of sugary drinks didn't change? And the answer lies in people's behavior. What people did in response to this tax was to drive outside of Philadelphia, where the tax didn't apply, and they bought their sugary drinks there. And while they're there, they went ahead and bought the rest of their groceries. And the tax ended up closing a number of grocery stores, particularly in low-income areas in the Philadelphia region. Why? People responded to this busy bullying, somebody telling them how they should behave, and this unintended consequence arose of people going out, buying their sugar drinks elsewhere, and what you had instead was grocery stores closing. Now, it's our tendency when we see problems to turn to government as the solution. And I'll tell you right off, government is an excellent solution for any number of problems. But it's a dangerous solution. I liken it to a chainsaw. If there's a tree that's down across the road and you need to get rid of it, you've got to have a chainsaw. That is the only tool that will do the job. But for God's sake, if you want to cut bread for your morning toast, don't use the chainsaw. And yet that's what we tend to do. We see problems and we turn to the chainsaw of government and we try to apply it to all the problems that we find. And often, not always, of course, but often what happens is we end up making a mess. Tonight, we want to talk about the four largest problems, perhaps, that we have applied government to. Perhaps the largest problem you could imagine government addressing is war. And in fact, these four that we want to talk about, we also call wars, although they aren't wars in the traditional sense. The war on poverty, the war on drugs, the war on terror, and the war on COVID. You might think I'm stretching the use of the word war here, but let me put this in perspective. Adjusted for inflation, World War II cost us $4 trillion. That's adjusted for inflation. The war on COVID, any ideas what that cost us? Current estimates are eight, twice the cost of World War II. The war on poverty, adjusted for inflation, you're not going to believe me when I tell you. The war on poverty has cost us to date $23 trillion. So when we use the word war here, we actually mean it. Yes, there aren't people going out and shooting other people, but in terms of the magnitude of the undertaking, if the war on poverty, the war on drugs, the war on terror, the war on COVID matches or exceeds many of the 12 wars in which we have ever been engaged in.
And if you add up all of those numbers, you end up finding out that we owe more money on these sorts of things than our federal debt would indicate. It actually makes the federal debt look small.
Coincidentally, if you add these up, war on poverty, drugs, terror, COVID, that's actually larger than our federal debt. Our federal debt's currently about $30 trillion. Those numbers add up to about $32.
And when we wrote the book a couple of years ago, it was roughly the same. So we've seen these things gain some steam and start heading down a very, very bad road for us. And Ant, when you started talking about Philadelphia and the sugary tax business, this is actually probably what caused us to write the book in the first place, because we wrote a couple of articles about this attack on fat people, I think is probably the right answer. We took a look at that and said, well, if a government thinks it can manage to do that, we've got a couple of things to say about it. And the first, incentives matter. If you incentivize a bunch of people to behave in a certain way, they will absolutely do that. I don't know how we keep finding that to be strange. But if you think about Philadelphia, Philadelphia is a city that is relatively poor. They can't afford to run their own schools, right? This is a constant issue for them. When their politicians passed this act, what they ended up doing was not only sending people out of Philadelphia, but they sent people out of Pennsylvania, right across the George Washington Bridge into Camden, New Jersey. So not only did they take apart their own economy, they boosted the struggling economy of Camden, New Jersey. We were beneficiaries of this sort of thing. And when you think about this, when you see how this works, you see that mindset where people say, hey, wait a minute, I know how to fix this. And then they talk amongst themselves and they figure out some ridiculous plan that's never going to work. How do I know that? Because they never do. I've got 200 years of evidence to support my assertion. And yet, they follow through with it almost every time. And when Ant and I made the connection from this Philadelphia business, and it was a small thing. I think they put out of business five or six grocers in the first year after the tax. That number continues to climb, but it's not like every store in Philadelphia shut down. But then we started thinking about how that observation works across cases. And we started to realize that when we talk about these wars on nouns, which I think became the central focus of the book, all we have are losers. You get the occasional winner, especially with the war on terror. You can see where the money flows, and it's a lot of money. It's not a rising tide that lifts all boats. It's a certain kind of gratuity that emerges from a government which is no longer looking after the interest of its people.
This becomes a dangerous thing. James used the phrase war on nouns, which is what we call these things. When we attempt to wage war on a noun, drugs, terror, what have you, you can't wage war on this inanimate thing. And so the mechanisms that we put in place start to change their focus. And the war on drugs ceases to be a war on drugs. It becomes a war on drug users. The war on poverty ceases to be a war on poverty. It becomes a war on poor people. Things that we never intended, they simply arise because when we put this mechanism in place to address this problem, and it's not the right tool for addressing the problem, the tool finds a use for itself. Case in point, take the TSA. The TSA, by its own admission, is incompetent. The TSA tests its own checkpoints. Their failure rate, by failure rate, what I mean is the TSA will bring testers and put through, unbeknownst to the TSA agents, actual weapons, try to get them through the checkpoint. Do you know what fraction of weapons typically make it through? I think TSA has gotten better, actually, in the past few years.
The old answer was 90%.
Yeah, the old time was 95%. The first couple of years this was tried. 95%, that's not success rate, that's failure rate. They've dramatically improved. The last that I saw, their failure rate is now 70%.
And yet they confiscate my peanut butter every time I try to get it through. They stole a butter knife from me not too long ago.
This microphone I have here comes in two parts. The round part looks, I guess, on an X-ray machine exactly like some explosive would look. And then you've got this thing and the wires and all of that. I get through probably 75% of the time without anybody saying anything.
It happened on my way here. I brought with me a bunch of gear. And they sent my bag through, and the lady said, we have to check that again.
Right.
And then they checked it again, and apparently a miracle happened, and they didn't have to bother anymore. When Denver decided they were going to stop enforcing marijuana laws, and then they did more positive things later, but it was really just a cessation at first, they realized that the city hadn't become a post-apocalyptic hellscape at all. People had predicted this, and yet it didn't happen. And Ant and I looked at this data a year later. Remember the one-year point? And crime across every single category was down in Denver, even murder. We have no idea why that would happen. We don't seem to think that marijuana and murder run in lockstep with each other, but it was a curiosity in the data. At the very least, we can conclude immediately that bad things did not happen. And then I go to Denver, and a friend of mine lives there, and I say, drive me around and show me what dispensaries look like. I've never seen one. And he did, and he pointed them all out. And I remembered a student I had in 1997. She said to me one day, Professor Hagen, do you ever think marijuana will be legal? I said, not in my lifetime. A few years later, I'm in Denver, and it's absolutely legal. I wanted to go inside. I wanted to see the inside of the dispensary. And we walked in, and a bunch of people were walking up, buying what they wanted, paying with cash, and then leaving. They couldn't use bank cards at the time because the federal law was being broken in so doing. And my friend looked at me and he said, can you imagine how many lives were absolutely ruined because of the transaction we just saw where two people got exactly what they wanted? One person wanted marijuana more than he wanted money. One person wanted money more than he wanted marijuana. And here you go. And yet, when I lived in New York State for a period of years, if you had a half an ounce, you're probably going to prison. These are the sorts of stories that we see every time we talk about a war on nouns. And you can think about the war on poverty. We've been at this since the early 1960s. Ronald Reagan became president in the 80s and said we had a war on poverty. Poverty won.
I started TSA. He talks about drugs and now poverty. In none of these cases are we implicating the people involved. It's not that the TSA people are stupid. It's not that the people who regulate drugs or try to solve the poverty problem are stupid or malicious or any of that. It's none of that. Rather, the incentives are wrong. Nobody has a personal incentive beyond the, I'm going to work for what's good for society and stop the terrorists from getting through. Beyond that, no one has a direct incentive. The TSA fails in its job. What happens? We give it more money. If anything, there's a perverse incentive to not do your job well. I'm not suggesting that's what they do. I'm just saying that the incentives are not designed to give us the outcomes we want. In the case of drugs, one of the concerns in legalizing marijuana was, look, there are going to be people out there trying to make a profit off of these drugs. What are they going to do? They're going to sell drugs to minors. Because why? They can make more money doing that. And so absolutely, this is something we should prohibit. That misunderstands the incentives. If we look at Denver, you can go there and see stores that sell marijuana. And what do you see? You have to walk in through a glass door that's locked. Someone has to buzz you in. And you're in a holding area. And then the second door buzzes and you walk through that. It's designed specifically so that nobody gets into the store without having their ID checked to make sure that you're not a minor, you're eligible to buy the drugs or whatever it is.
It turns out it's harder to buy marijuana than it is to vote.
Yeah, it's harder to buy marijuana in Denver illegally than it is to vote illegally.
In Tucson, where I live as well.
Now, think that through. What's going on is a story about incentives. The private marijuana dispensary owner has invested in this business hundreds of thousands of dollars in the business and the licensing, the building, the employees, the inventory, all of that. All of which is gone if the guy is caught selling to minors. If you think about his incentives, he has a tremendous incentive to do exactly what we want him to do, which is don't sell to minors. Now, shift your thinking and go back to a world in which the marijuana is illegal. And so we've got a guy on the street corner selling it. That guy does not have the incentive to avoid selling to the minor. Why? He's going to jail if he's caught selling at all. Selling to the minor is not any worse than selling to anybody else. I'm going to go to jail either way, and I'll get some more money by selling to the minor. So if you follow the incentives, which is what hopefully you learn in economics, it's the incentives that drive people's behavior. You see that a law intended, understandably, to prevent drugs from getting into the hands of minors actually encourages drugs to get into the hands of minors if you craft the law in a certain way. That is, you say, okay, it's going to be illegal, nobody can sell it, rather than it's legal and you can sell it and we'll give you a license provided you don't sell it to minors.
The drug laws in Connecticut, where I grew up, gave me one of the all-time funniest moments of my life. When I was walking with my mother down near Yale University, which is not a great neighborhood, and a guy came up to me with a big paper grocery bag, opened it up to show me all the weed inside and said, what do you want? And my mother said, what's he talking about? And we had to have a frank exchange of views later. But nobody had to push drugs on anybody. This idea of a drug pusher is ridiculous. People offer drugs, they don't push them. And there's a gigantic market for them. And when we listen to the market, you can start making peace with what people want. And then you have to answer, why is your opinion so important when you say they shouldn't be able to have what they want? I'll point to Portugal, which I think is effectively no more drug laws at all. I haven't been to Portugal yet, but I have been to Amsterdam a number of times. And when you get there, you realize that they've got kind of a massive drug business. They make this following distinction. If it's natural, you can get away with selling it there. So marijuana, hashish, and mushrooms, all right out of the counter. But anything that's processed, meth, crack, you can't get those. And I think as a matter of shorthand, that's actually not a bad way to go. And what did I see when I was in Amsterdam? I saw any number of things that would have been a crime here that people roll their eyes there. I find that they're more forgiving about the different sorts of things that people might want. Now, that's going to cause a certain distaste for some people. I think you just have to admit that and move on. But I think as far as these sorts of things go, their ideas are better than our ideas. Although we seem to be walking a bit down that road now, and we turn around and look around, and it doesn't seem to have caused a whole lot of problems.
To tie this back to the idea of busy bullies, part of the reason we end up here so often is because if I'm going to decide how you should live, it's easy for me to see and to describe the end result. A world without drugs, a world without terror, a world without poverty. I can see the end. Without thinking through how do I get from where I am now to that end, I just enact a law that says, let there be no drugs, let there be no poverty, whatever it is. And in so doing, I create incentives that often, not always, but often bring about the exact opposite of the effect that I want. That is, it's easy to imagine the end result It's very hard to imagine the path to get to the end result, but it's the path that matters. And I'd give you an example with our war on poverty. The war on poverty in this country started in 1967 when Lyndon Johnson signed into law the first laws intended to help the poor. Now, as I start down this path, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying we should do nothing to help the poor. Actually, I would say the exact opposite of that. What I am going to argue to you is that what we have been doing hasn't been working, and it hasn't been working for predictable reasons. We started in 1967 with the war on poverty. At that time, in this country, the poverty rate in the United States was approximately 13%. That war on poverty has gone on since 1967 at a cumulative cost adjusted for inflation of $23 trillion. Do you know what's happened to our poverty rate since then? It has stayed right there at 13%. Some years a little bit more, some years a little bit less. It fluctuates up and down, but it's pretty horizontal.
If anybody could have predicted such a thing.
Right. So the question is, how is it possible that we can spend more money than most countries make in a year on poverty and have no effect whatsoever? And the answer lies in the fact that the war on poverty morphed into a war on poor people. Because you can't wage war against a concept, but you can wage war against people. And nobody intended it to happen, but here's how it evolved. We create some government programs designed to help the poor. And at first, this is excellent because people are involved, they're looking to help the poor, and they've got access to resources to do this, and they've got ideas of what they can do, and they start working. We're going to help the poor. And I'm not saying they don't have successes. Certainly, they do have some successes. They have some setbacks. But notice something interesting, particularly where government is concerned. When they have setbacks, and you hear this story every time with regard to government undertakings. When they have setbacks, what's the answer? The answer's always spend more money. We didn't do enough. Or there weren't enough programs, we're now going to found some more. We pile more money into it. And what kind of incentive do you construct when you start doing that? You start creating inside these agencies, inside these programs, bureaucracies that live off of this funding. There's a large swath of Americans who actually make their living off of poor people. They work in these programs, in these agencies, and they're paid to help the poor. And every single one of them, I guarantee you, is good-hearted and say, yeah, I'm here, I want to help the poor. But what's in your heart doesn't always translate into your behavior. What does translate into your behavior is your incentive. And the incentive is, so long as there are poor people, more money keeps flowing into my department. In fact, if there are more poor people, even more money flows into my department. And so we have created in this country, since 1967, over 100 programs, not sequentially, they're all in existence right now, 100 programs aimed at helping the poor. And what do we have to show for that? The same 13% poverty rate that we've had since 1967. I claim for the same $23 trillion, we could have eliminated poverty 50 years ago. We could have been the first society in the history of Homo sapiens to have zero poverty, not just once, but consistently over a half century. We could have done that for the same $23 trillion that we spent. And how do you do it? You cut each poor person a check for $10,000. That's it. You don't need 100 programs. Every poor person in the United States, man, woman, child, check for $10,000, yes, adjusted for inflation, $10,000 a year, every year so long as you're poor. That would have given us a poverty rate of zero from 1967 to now for the same $23 trillion. We didn't do it because there's no incentive to do it. You don't get the big programs that employ all sorts of people. More importantly, the politicians don't get to say, look, elect me and I'll put this new poverty program in our city. It's going to mean more jobs. It's going to be better for the poor, all of this. And you cheer and you vote for me. And my opponent who's running against me is hoping that my program is not a success. Because so long as it's not a success, he can come back at the next election and say, this guy promised the world, he delivered nothing, elect me, I'll fix it for you. And I'm hoping to God that if he wins, he doesn't solve the problem either, because on the next election, I'm going to come back and say, I told you so. You went and elected this guy. He didn't do anything for you. Elect me and I'll fix the problem. And notice what happens. The politicians themselves have an incentive for poverty to persist because they can continually use it to get elected.
It's not really as nefarious as it sounds. It really is driven by incentives. But when we started to take a look at all of the various programs that exist to address poverty, I was horrified by the answers I was getting. I knew it was going to be bad, but I had no idea how bad it was going to be. And we decided that we would construct a list and present it as a single sentence. It's, I think, the longest sentence either of us will ever write. But it includes the name of every single program.
It's in the book. It's 2.5 pages long, a single sentence.
It just goes on and on and on and on. And you have to realize at some point, as I think we had that moment of epiphany, when you see something right in front of you and you say, God, I always knew it was bad, but look at this. This is just ridiculous. And map that against your lived experience, because you have seen politicians do this time and time again. They start by saying, imagine how bad it would have been if we hadn't done what we did. Well, there's no evidence to support that assertion at all. And people just kind of nod their heads and smile. And then the punchline is, of course, so now we need more money. And you never see these things disappear. What do you see instead? You see all of the same social problems that we ever had, and a growing budget deficit, which yields a growing debt, which is likely never to be repaid, which is going to come back on us in the form of inflation. Ant and I have been predicting inflation for a while, and here we are. It's about 7% right now. And I can't imagine that doesn't keep going higher.
James used the word nefarious, and I think that's good as well. Again, I want to underline, we're not saying here that the problem is that people are evil and people who work in the poverty programs are horrible or stupid or anything. Nothing like that. I'm sure in the public sector, there are some stupid and selfish people, just like there are in the private sector. And in the public sector, I know there are some altruistic and brilliant people, just like there are in the private sector. It's the same brand of Homo sapien in both places. What makes things not always work in the public sector is this issue of incentives. We have a tendency to think in terms of outcomes rather than in terms of paths to the solution. And we enact laws that actually give people perverse incentives, that encourage them to behave in ways that don't lead to the solution. Rather, they just lead to us feeling better that perhaps we've solved this thing when in fact we haven't. Good case in point is COVID. COVID comes along, and for all understandable reasons, people were terrified of this. And as people became terrified, the media picked it up, because the media, like everybody else, is driven by incentives. Their incentives are to sell advertising. And what sells advertising? Things that scare you. How do I know this? There are websites out there, CNN, Fox News, ABC, that will tell you all the horrible things that are happening in the world. And there are websites out there that will tell you only good things that are happening in the world.
Like three.
Yeah. Nobody looks at those websites. They all go to the other ones. I know these things exist and I don't look at them. They're boring, right? It's the bad news. It's the salacious news. It's the scary news. And so what happened is this cascade of incentives. This disease comes along and we become scared. The media picks up on that and they start showing us. And we start watching it, and they start selling advertising, because this is scary. And then all of a sudden, the politicians' incentives kick in, because if we're all up in arms, this is a scary thing, what do? We turn to government and say, what are you doing to fix this? And now politicians have to do something. And notice, they could err in one of two ways. I'll take the lockdowns as an example. They could have locked down when the lockdowns aren't necessary, or they could have failed to lock down when the lockdowns were necessary. Think again about politicians' incentives. What happens in those two scenarios? If the lockdown wasn't necessary and they did lock down, it's hard to come back to the politician there, because we can say to him, look, it wasn't necessary. You made us all stay home. You closed down the universities and closed down the stores and I'm out of a job. Why did you do that? And they will say exactly what James just said. Can you imagine how bad this would have been if I hadn't done that? And we're all being scared, we're being fed by the media, we say, oh yeah, that's probably right. Good thing he locked down. If he errs in the other direction, he doesn't lock down when he should, his error is immediately apparent in bodies. We can count how many deaths are attributable to this politician because he didn't lock down. And notice, from the politician's perspective, he faces an asymmetric choice. If he errs in this direction, not too much bad's going to happen to him. He can justify that. He errs in this direction, all hell breaks loose. And so what happens? All the politicians had incentive to err on the side of locking down. And what did we get? We can point to the fact that millions of people did not die of COVID, and we can say, okay, that's great, but it came at a cost. Calls to suicide hotlines in the United States rose 1,000% during the lockdowns. Our unemployment rate hit a high that hasn't been seen since the Great Depression. The government turned around and tried to fix that problem by spending $6 trillion on top of the money that it normally spends. We're going to have to pay that somehow in taxes in the future. There was an increase in incidents in domestic violence and drug use and alcoholism as people are despondent because they're cut off from other people and they're stuck at home and they lose their jobs. Interestingly, in the United States, we saw a spike in diseases involving kidneys. In Canada, they saw a spike in cancer deaths. Both of these things after the lockdowns ended. And in both countries, we start tracking this down, saying, why all of a sudden are so many Canadians dying of cancer? Why all of a sudden so many Americans have kidney disease? It's because during the age of COVID, A, the patients were scared to go to the hospital because of COVID. B, the hospitals were diverting their resources away from other diseases they would normally treat to spend more effort treating COVID. And for both of those reasons, people in Canada who needed treatment for cancer, people in this country who needed treatment for kidney disease, did not seek and get the treatment that they needed. And so now we're starting to see spikes in these problems.
And they're not going away anytime soon. We predicted this a long time ago, right when the first lockdowns began. We said the longer this lasts, the more people we're going to find who didn't go for routine maintenance on their bodies and would find out only too late that they've developed a condition which will end them. I think we're starting to see that now. But in the interest of full disclosure, yeah, sure, we predicted that. We were great. We got one completely wrong. I was utterly convinced, and I think Ant was too, that what we were going to see eventually was a COVID baby boom. It made perfect sense, right? You're locked up at home. Well, what are you going to do? And here's the weird part. That didn't happen. If anything, it went the other way. I can verify this anecdotally. It seems to be the case that we got fed up with each other pretty hard and pretty fast. And a baby boom not going to happen under those circumstances. Anthony Fauci would come on and say, look, this is what I got wrong. But apparently that word isn't in his repertoire. We get a number of things wrong each year. If you make the number of predictions we make, you're not going to get them all. I think I'm happy to own them. Those are our mistakes, and we own up to them. Why don't our politicians and our bureaucrats? Anthony Fauci has a vested interest in keeping himself in the center of every storm. If you look back in time and see the things he said, the egregiously wrong things he said when AIDS was first a public health issue in the United States, I don't know how he kept his jobs. He was so wrong. And I think you have to be honest about your successes and your failures. Our politicians specialize in only one of those things.
And that's all the time we've got this week on Words and Numbers. Until next time, be sure to follow us on Twitter. Handles are in the show notes. Join Words and Numbers Backstage, the Facebook group where the conversation continues. And
send us email, wordsandnumberspodcast@gmail.com.
Until next week, try to be nice to one person. One person who doesn't deserve it. Just one. And who knows, it may turn into a trend. Give it a shot. You might feel good about yourself.
You could say you tried.
You tried, that's right. Till next week, can't take it easy.
See you next week, James.